Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello and welcome to this week's podcast, Voices from the Irish Life and Lore Archive. I'm Maurice O'Keefe, and this week I'd like to pay a tribute to John Bellingham, who recently passed away. He was a great contributor to our archive. So in this week's podcast, you will hear some snippets taken from the many interviews that I did with John. Well, I'm here in Westmead and I'm talking to Johnny Bellingham. Johnny, the house that we're now in was once a Harvey Kelly house.
Kelly was at the Harvey, actually. The Kellys were a family who came originally from Roscommon and acquired a lot of land in Westmeath, in the center, this part of Westmeath, at the end of the 18th century. Mm-hmm. And the original place they had was Kellybrook, which is gone now. It wasn't very big, but there's a fine 18th century house called Lewinstown on the other side of the hill of Ashnagh. And then it was a younger son who built this house. And it was originally called Waterloo. And there's a stone, which I'll show you in the yard afterwards there, because apparently his father came along and said, where's Waterloo? The stone was originally in the porch of the church, and it says this church was built by William Mears Kelly of Waterloo Esquire, the year, etc. And his old father from Lewinstown said, did you fight at Waterloo? Did I fight at Waterloo? What's all this? So he wouldn't let him call him that. So the stone had to be removed from the church, and he chipped away the word church, and it's put over the coach house there. But the Kellys then actually divided into various branches, the Harvey Kellys and the Hume Kellys. I mean, they're all quite closely related. And my parents actually bought this house in the 1930s from Major Hume Kelly, who would have been a first cousin, or maybe a second cousin, I'm not sure, of Colonel Harvey Kelly, who is the father of the present Colonel William Harvey Kelly.
Whom you met.
I spoke to.
So
they were all army people, of course. The Colonel Harvey Kelly, William's father, had been in the Indian Army. Major Hume Kelly had been in the First War.
What was your father's first name?
His name was Arthur Stewart, known as Stewart. My grandfather was Arthur. My great-grandfather was William. He was the one who built the cliffs. He had many children. Arthur was the youngest, and my grandmother was a Hearn of the family of the artist Nathaniel Hearn and all that. And then what happened was that long after the war, when my father finally retired from the British Army, his ambition had been to farm on a rather larger scale than was possible on the Hill of Hoe, because we only have 60 acres there. It may sound a lot now, 60 acres in a built-up area like the Hill of Hoe, but it was a pocket handkerchief as far as a farm was concerned then.
Yeah.
So he had married my mother, who was a Scottish heiress. And so the upshot was that my Scottish grandfather sold a tenant farm in Ayrshire of ours for £2,500, I think it was, 120 acres. And with that sum, he bought from Major Harvey Kelly this place, Glencara, which was by 350 acres. But it was at the height of the Depression because De Valera had, of course, ruined Irish agriculture at the time, as everybody knows.
Yes, give me your description of what happened and why.
Well, again, this applies more to the Hill of Howth. My father had decided to plough one of the fields, and he had a man who worked for him called Michael Riley. And so he was ploughing this field. I don't know what they were going to sow in it, whether it was corn or potatoes, I don't know. But my father was on the tram, which then existed, going into Dublin, and looking over another gentleman's shoulder who was reading the Irish Times, he saw the headline that Dev had won the election. And so my father, having studied Dev's pre-electoral promises, realised what the consequences of this would be. So he hopped off the tram, walked back, and said to Michael Riley, "Did you ever turn a furrow back?" So Michael Riley looked very blank and said no. And he said, "Well, it's quite simple. We take off the sock of the plough, we turn it round the other way, and then we proceed back, and the plough will turn the furrow back." And he said, "Why are you doing this?" And he said, "Because Dev has announced that he's going to stop the payment of the annuities to the British government. And the British government had said, if you do that, we will put a tariff on your cattle." And that was the main export. Ireland's main export was cattle, and to Britain, not to anywhere else, really. And so my father, like many others, had foreseen that it would mean the ruin of Irish agriculture. Dev promised cheap food for the people in the towns and all that, and on yes. the strength of that, he got in. But of course, as everybody knows, it ruined Irish agriculture.
You've moved into the library here, and this library, was this part of your family's...
This was my Scottish grandfather's library. And it was in one long room. And so when it was... eventually, the house was sold and demolished. But before that happened, my mother rescued the library with the panelling and brought it over here. And then the local carpenter, Duffy from Kinnair, reconstructed it all and set it up in this room.
It's lovely to have this.
This is yes. pure Ayrshire. Yes. All this yes. came from Ayrshire. See, what had yes. happened was that the Major Hume Kelly, from whom we bought the place, he had a brother whom the locals remember when we first came here. They referred to him as Mr. Georgie. And he was the more popular one. He, of course, was the one who was killed in the Great War. Major Hume Kelly survived the war. But he married a French lady. People joked that she was literally Mademoiselle from Armentières, as in the song, because I think Armentières was where she actually came from. But setting her here in the Troubles, she didn't like it at all. And she was quite frightened, and she wasn't used to this sort of life. And so she wouldn't stay here. And the house was occupied in the Troubles by the IRA. And that gave her a shock. They'd been over to dine with at the nearest big house across there, Middleton, with the Boyd Rothschilds. And they came home in the Napoleon trap and found the IRA in occupation. And so they had to turn around and go back to Middleton to spend the night there. But she swore she was never going to come back to Ireland after that. So he, in fact, she made him buy a house near Dover where she could look across on a clear day, see her beloved France. And she never set foot in Ireland again. And he used to come over regularly, and he'd take the train as far as Castle Dungeon. We had a railway there, and he kept a bicycle there, and he bicycled from Castle Dungeon down here and looked after the place, but eventually got too much for him, and very regretfully, he sold it, and it was my parents who bought it. This would have been in about 1936.
Mm-hmm. You must talk to me about Howth and the farm and the
Well, you see, my father was... my father's father had died when he was quite young. He hardly remembers his father. And his mother, as I say, was a Miss Hone,
of that family, the Nathaniel Hearn, Horace Hearn, and all that lot, Evie Hearn, and all that lot. And so my father was an only child, living with a very elderly mother, because she was quite old when my father was born. In fact, she was quite old when she married, and he was her only child. He, as a matter of fact, there was an interesting feature about that, because he was very keen on carpentry. And at his boarding school in England, which was Radley, he had built himself a boat in the carpentry workshop, a small sailing boat. And so he brought it over on the mail boat. Because one of the things he used to say in those days, when you took the mail boat, that you were reminded when you boarded the boat at Kingstown, as it was then called, that before you landed at Holyhead, you had to put your watch 25 minutes forward. And you were reminded the other way around, before landing at Kingstown, to be sure and put your watch 25 minutes back. Because until 1917, we had our own time in Ireland. It was universal for the whole of Ireland, for the whole of island of Ireland. Though, mind you, it was never accepted down here, where we had another time, which was called God's time. Actually, when I was growing up here, the summertime wasn't really accepted by the country people, and they refused to put their clocks forward in summertime. And of course, not many of them had a wireless then, so you had to be very precise whether you meant new time or old time. But round here, it was even different, because we had God's time. Because what had happened was that Dublin was 25 minutes behind Greenwich. But when you got down to the Midlands, you were another 5 minutes behind Greenwich, because about every 10 miles, you lost a minute as you were further west.
Yes.
So here in the Midlands, we were precisely half an hour behind Greenwich. And before Longford Cathedral was built, the pro-cathedral for the Roman Catholic Diocese of Ardagh and Clonmacnoise was in Ballymahon, which is only about one time minute away from here. And so the parish priest had the bishop had a sundial in his garden, and he said that in his diocese they were going to keep God's time. They weren't interested in Dublin time or Greenwich time. So the Angelus was to be rung at what in winter other people called 6:30, and of course what in the morning that in, and what in the summer would have been 7:30. So we had God's time here, which is 5 minutes behind old time.
Right. But in the meantime, what was happening with your father's life?
I mean, what had happened? He
went to school, did he?
He went to school in England. But then the thing was, he'd bought his boat. He built his boat. And he brought his boat over, and he was launching it in Howth Harbour. Now, at some time in 1914 or 13, I'm not sure. Well, what happened was, I went to a lecture, actually, only two nights ago in Howth, on the Jemison family by a man called Ian Robertson, who's an historian. And he told us a lot about Andrew Jemison, who lived at Sutton House on the Hill of Howth, who was chairman of Jemison's, and he was a very prominent politician. Then he was a senator of the Irish Free State. And he was a great unionist. I don't know whether he was... I don't think he was a member of Parliament. Well, I could be wrong. I don't know about that. He certainly had several political positions, and he was my father's godfather. And my father being a young man of, my father was born in 1893, so he must have been sort of rising 20 at the time. And he sent word over to my grandmother, who, as I say, was a widow there, that he'd like my father to come over because he had a special mission for him. And so my father found himself with two or three other young men about his own age who were probably going to Trinity. And they were piled into a Model T Ford. They didn't know where they were going. And they were driven up to Larne. Now, it should be said that Andrew Jemison on the grand piano always had a photograph of Carson.
Yes.
And so they arrived up at Larne. And this ship, shortly after, came in. So this gang of young men that had been probably fellow Trinity students, like my father, that Andrew Jemison had recruited, they were found themselves unloading the rifles off this boat that had come in. And it was done very efficiently, apparently, at the dead of night, and the rifles all disappeared up into the hills. And so that was my father taking part in the Larne gun running. Then he was down in Howth, messing about in his boat with his friends, the fishermen, and there was a fearful commotion going on. My father didn't know what it was. But then he gathered that they'd tied up the coast guards and they'd cut the cables. And the next thing is the Asgard sailed in. Yeah. And so the fishermen, who some of whom were sympathisers, had been primed about this, so they all formed a human chain unloading the rifles, including my father with his friends. So my father was part of the human chain that unloaded the rifles, took them off the Asgard, and then they were duly taken by the volunteers, and the rest is history. You know, they marched into Dublin and the Battle of Fairview and all
did
that.
Did he know Mary Spring Rice, or did he know Childers at all?
Not at all. Not at all. He didn't move in those exalted circles. He was just a young man at Trinity, quite modest. No. Those exalted people in high society.
But what happened then? Because he enlisted to join.
Oh yes, but that was yes. But I mean, my father had no political sympathies. I mean, he wasn't a unionist. It wasn't unionism that brought him up to Larne. It was simply that his godfather told him there was a knight's adventure ahead, which he looked forward to, and then he found himself purely by chance in the middle of the Howth gun running.
So was he a sympathiser then?
He didn't have political sympathies at all. He just enjoyed. He just enjoyed adventure, and he liked, and he was friends with all the fishermen, and the fishermen, apparently, a good many of them were sympathisers. They were his friends, and so he found himself doing.
So, but was he torn between two sides?
He didn't have sympathies. He wasn't interested in that. You don't see it like that. He didn't see it like that. He was a young man, and
I think did your grandfather support?
My grandfather was long dead.
Was dead at this stage?
Yes.
So did your father? Would he have seen Redmond as a?
I told you, my father was not a politician.
Not a politician.
He was
at
not
all.
Interested in politics. Yep. He was not remotely interested in politics, and he had no use for politicians. He had a great respect for Andrew Jemison. Obviously, he was his godfather, and he was our very prominent, well off neighbour.
Yeah.
But
he must have got to know all the people who were his friends who were offloading the rifles from
his friends were the fishermen. They weren't Miss Spring Rice or they weren't Childers.
Yes, but they were the volunteers who were helping to take the guns off.
I don't think the volunteers were helping. I think they were handed to the volunteers, from the way I understood it. I think it was the fishermen, actually, who did. Well, there may have been some volunteers on the boat. But the volunteers, I understand, were on the quay. And they're the ones who on the West Pier, they're the ones who then marched off in great array.
Well, I'm here in Howth and I'm talking to John Bellingham. And John, it's lovely to be revisiting your lovely house down here in Howth, which is a beautiful spot where you are.
Well, we're on the south side of the peninsula, and this house was built in three stages. The earliest one was really like a seaside cottage, which was built just before the famine, but I don't have an exact date for it. And then around 1900, my grandmother added a wing. And then after the last war, my parents in about 1946 added a top story. So that it looks quite different to what it did. The original house was much more attractive, and it was low, and it was because of the bank in front of it that threw the winds up and over it. You didn't really get you weren't too much battered by the winds. But the top story that my parents put on, that does get the wind. But it's down a long avenue by the sea, and it was bought originally from the Pyle estate, which had been part of the Howth estate. I think a Lord Howth at some stage, I'm not sure about this, must have mortgaged part of his land to Mr. Pyle, whoever he was. And my great-grandfather had a house in County Kildare, but he and his wife, who was his first cousin, had the idea that sea bathing was good, and they had a large family, I think about three daughters and five sons. And so they built this place. Lord Howth at the time, who was the landlord of most of the peninsula and indeed some of the land between the Isthmus and the Howth estate, I think, went as far as Ruhini anyway. He didn't want a road being built on the south side. So my great-grandfather was forced to build his own harbour, which is still there. And then he brought most of the materials to build this house by sea.
And was it in this house that you grew up, John?
Not really grow up. My paternal grandmother lived here, and we used to make visits to her. No, my mother was Scottish, 100% Scottish, and my father was in the British Army. And my brother and I were actually left in Scotland with the maternal grandparents in Ayrshire, where we spent our earliest childhood. My father was still in the army. His mother was living here. He was an only child. And when he left the army, he wanted to farm in a rather bigger way than he could here, because this is a very small farm. It's only about 60 acres. So my Scottish grandparents bought for them from the Kelly family, Glencara, which is in County Westmeath. And so our childhood was really divided between Westmeath and Ayrshire. But then on the way to Ayrshire, we used to take the Burnsland boat from the North Wall to the Brimelore on the Clyde. And we'd spend a night here with my paternal grandmother. We called her Granny B. And my mother's maiden name was Arthur, so the grandmother in Scotland was Granny A. But we would only spend a night or so here.
What was her name, your grandmother that was here?
Her Christian name was Nanny. She was actually christened Nanny. Her maiden name was Hone, and she was a relation of
an Italian Hone.
Of Nathaniel yeah. Hone and Hollis Hone and all those. And indeed, she was a cousin of the famous Professor Mahaffey, because his mother had been a Hone. The Hones were an artistic family. And my grandmother, Granny B, she herself was artistic and very clever with her hands. She carved that fireplace there, and she painted the Chinese cabinet, which is above here.
Oh, very beautiful.
She was a widow for most of her life, because my grandfather, her husband, had died young. My father hardly knew his father. He was very young when he died. So my father really was an only child, and he was brought up here by his mother before he went to join the army.
And so, but life in Howth wasn't for you in your young days. You were, as you say, brought up in Scotland, in Ayrshire. And then you split, you came on holidays.
Yes, the thing was, I never really knew much about Howth because only what I was told, because we didn't spend very much time here then. It was only after my grandmother died that we spent more time here, because then my father had left the army by then, and then they took over the house. But the earliest childhood was between Ayrshire and Westmeath.
Oh, where were you educated?
Well, first of all, we had governesses, of course, and as they did in those days. And then the first school I was sent to was a prep school in Hertfordshire. I got ill, I remember, and I was sent home, and I was convalescing here, and I had a governess here. And so I spent quite a lot of time alone in this house with my governess.
And that's when I really got to know some parts of the Hill of Howth. There was an old gentleman called Sir John Lumsden who lived in a house called Earlscliffe at the end of Central Road, and he had budgerigars, and my grandmother had budgerigars, and I inherited the budgerigars from my grandmother, and he and I used to exchange budgerigars. And I knew the Lumsdens very well, but my parents actually didn't know them, and they were rather jealous of me that I was acquainted with them and they were not. But that's the way things were.
And what happened afterwards?
Well, then the school that I'd been to, it was called Lockers Park in near Hemel Hempstead in Hertfordshire. I don't know what happened, but on account of the war, they'd lost a lot of their pupils. And so there was a school called Wellesley House, which had been at Broadstairs, just on the Kentish coast. I never went there. But that school, in the meantime, had been evacuated to the Highlands of Scotland, because it so happened that one of their pupils owned a shooting lodge on Loch Rannoch. So when I went back to school, it was to Wellesley House, which in fact was in the north of Perthshire, in what was then still a Gaelic-speaking area. And we were split up between various lodges around Loch Rannoch. And one of the things, of course, that English schools are very keen on is cricket. They had great difficulty in having a cricket pitch because they couldn't find any level ground. It was so very hilly. But we had a wonderful time there because the loch froze over, those who could skate used to skate on the loch with a toboggan and go down to Kinloch Rannoch to get supplies. And that school got a whole new clientele of Scottish boys from different parts of the Highlands. And it's a time that I enjoyed very much indeed.
And so you had to think of the future and what you would do.
Oh, I didn't think of the future in those days.
In those
I had absolutely no thought about that at the time.
Did you have somebody who maybe inspired you? Who were the people that, you know, were your mentors along the way? Was it your grandmother or was it your...
I don't know, really. The Irish grandmother had died by then. My Scottish grandmother, she was very kind, but she didn't sort of direct us in any particular way. But on her side, we did have a family business in Glasgow, and I think there was always a suggestion that one of us might go into that.
What kind of business was it?
It was a big warehouse. My great-grandfather was the founder of it, and he was a very humble origin, but he died a multimillionaire. And his sons then branched out into a very different sort of life, and they bought properties in North Ayrshire, and they went hunting and but then of course during the war our house actually was requisitioned by the Air Force. And we never got it back. It was in a ruined state by the time they did. And my grandmother moved into a small house in Ayr at the time.
Mm-hmm. And so were you kind of thrown around the place, you know, from one house to another, or did you...
Well, not really thrown around, but I mean...
You know what I mean.
My brother was a bit older, and he had been... He didn't come to the school on Loch Rannoch. He stayed on at Lockers Park, and then he went to the public school that my father had been to, which was Radley. And he was about 4 years older than I was. And then from Radley, by the time he left Radley, he was called up and he entered the Merchant Navy, and I was sent to Eton, and then.
What year was this?
Oh, gosh. It was sort of at the beginning of the war. Mm-hmm. Because we'd had actually... we'd had two governesses before the war. There was a French one whose name we never really knew. She was just Mademoiselle.
And then there was a Fräulein also. Mm-hmm. So that we were brought up actually to quite early on to speak French and German. But then, of course, once the war broke out, the governesses had to go back to their respective homelands. Mm-hmm. And so then we reverted to talking only English.
And did you think about entering the army yourself? Was that...
Oh, no, not at all. No, not at all. I mean, my father, of course, was a professional soldier. But the thing was, I needn't have gone into the army at all. But my companions, being Irish, there was no obligation. But all the same, my companions from Eton, and the war was still on at the time, they automatically were called up. And my father thought that a bit of military training would be good for me. So he wasn't opposed to the idea. And so I joined up. I registered that and was posted to Caterham, which was the guards' training depot. And then there was a test that one did called a WASB to decide whether one was suitable for officer material. I was a hopeless athlete, and I failed the WASB. So whereas all my companions went on to become officers, I was a humble trooper, not commissioned, and at the time it was a great disappointment and pretty rough. But in point of fact, I'm very glad that I had that experience, because my contemporaries, whom I met again at Cambridge, at the university, in the meantime, in the army, of course, I couldn't speak to them. I had to salute them when they passed, and they pretended not to know me. But I got to know a whole raft of society which I never would have known, because my companions were dockers and coal miners and fishermen mm-hmm. from Grimsby and all that sort of thing. But still, I had a pretty easy time, because owing to the fact that I spoke German, the intelligence officer took me on as his interpreter. And see, some of my jobs was going to talk to the German farmers about compensation, because the regiment, being a mechanized regiment, the armored cars drove across the field of the German farmers, and then we had to talk about compensation.
I
got to know a great many Germans at the time, including a wonderful old retired general called General von Jena, who had been an ADC to the Kaiser in his exile in Doorn in Holland.
My goodness.
And he had fascinating stories about the old imperial German court. I think I got far more out of my military service than my companions who became officers, because I was much closer to the SSA, both to get to know working class, really rough working class British chaps and Germans.
Mm-hmm. And when you went into university then, you said you went to...
Yes, I...
Cambridge, was it?
Yes, I was invalided out because I broke my arm in a traffic accident in the army. And so I think I came out a bit earlier. Then I went almost straight up to Cambridge, and I did 3 years in... 3 years in Cambridge.
And what did you study?
Modern languages, and then went on to comparative philology, which is a wonderful thing, because you learned about languages without actually learning them. And I enjoyed Cambridge very much. Though it gave me rather snobbish ideas, because I was living, my friends were young men who were much better off than I was, and I got into rather extravagant habits. And then, most of them went on to get a job in the Foreign Office or something like that. But I went into the family business in Glasgow, and I lived with my grandmother, who by this time had moved into a small house in Ayr. And so I went up daily to business, but I think I was very tiresome, because I'd rather snobbish ideas, and I didn't really appreciate my grandmother's wisdom.
Yes, but all the time, your father was living here.
My father was living between here and Westmeath.
And Westmeath,
yes.
And you were in Scotland, so.
Well, I was living with my grandmother in Scotland, but you see, my elder brother He'd been in the Merchant Navy, and he came out, and he was supposed to inherit all this and to succeed, but he and my father actually rather fell out, and so my older brother got married, and he went off on his own way, and he became a land agent, and his first job was the assistant agent at Sandringham, and that was fascinating because he was there for George VI's funeral and was part of the team who had to arrange.
Very interesting.
To arrange the funeral, and then he got a job as a land agent to Lord Coventry, but then he joined the Leicestershire Yeomanry because he'd only been an able seaman. And my father was convinced that there'd be a Third World War quite soon. And so he wanted him to be an officer. So he entered the Leicestershire Yeomanry. And it was while he was with the Leicestershire Yeomanry and they were on manoeuvres in Wales that there was an accident. And his driver, who curiously enough was also Irish, came from Tullamore. They were both killed when the scout car overturned on them.
Mm-hmm.
But in the meantime, my younger brother had come along, Andrew. And I'd never really shown any much interest in the farming. And after I left the family business, which shortly after that was sold, I went to Paris and became a student again, as I'd been at Cambridge.
You have been listening to the late John Bellingham. If you would like to get more information or listen to John's full interview, you can do so by going on our website and search John Bellingham. I'm Maurice O'Keefe, and I look forward to bringing you another podcast soon.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.